Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, the chairman has just said that some of you are probably wondering why he was selected to occupy the chair this evening. He was also wondering. Some of you are probably wondering why I've been asked to speak to you this evening, and I also am wondering. I would like to thank the chairman for his very kind and flattering introductory remarks, and I hope that it hasn't raised any of your hopes too high. I'd like also, before starting to address you, I would like to thank my colleagues in the Faculty of Applied Science and in the University Library for the great help they've given me in the preparation of some of the data which I want to use tonight. I don't want to mention them all by name because there are too many, but I'm very grateful to them. The scientific and technological developments of the last half century have had such an effect on our material standards of living, our comfort, our security, and our ways of thought, that a consideration of the next 50 years not only gives us cause for a great deal of alarm, but it cannot fail to arouse, even in the most incurious amongst us, a sense of excitement and anticipation. We live in an age of sudden and dramatic change, and we have in our hands, as never before, the power of determining the future of the material world, whether it be for good or for evil. A person asked to predict the future of engineering, which is concerned with this material welfare of the world, even for a period as short as 50 years in the whole era of civilization, would require at one time the wisdom of Solomon, the philosophic insight of Einstein, and perhaps the versatility of Da Vinci. And to make a story of this kind acceptable to a wide and varied audience, an enlightened audience, he would also expect to have the imagination and the literary ability of H.G. Wells or Jules Verne. So let me say, first of all, that I do not claim any of these qualities at all. I'm speaking to you simply as one of the many who are taking part in this evolutionary process which I've been asked to describe this evening. I'm one of those whose very occupation might be expected to prevent me from seeing the wood for the trees. Some of us engaged in this sort of occupation try and escape our surroundings from time to time, especially on an occasion like this, and try and see the wood from afar. But in doing so, we must have a limited view. And if I'm deficient in any of my remarks tonight, and if I fail to cover a very wide field, then you must, I hope, or you will, accept my apologies. My own observation of trends of engineering will probably differ from those of many of the audience. And at best, I can only tell you part of the story. I'm very gratified at being asked to address you, but my gratification is tempered by diffidence and humility. And I hope you will accept my statements and anything I say with sympathy, knowing that my guess is probably just as liable to error as your own. Now, before this audience, I don't think it's necessary for me to draw a distinction between the professional activity known as engineering and the variety of skill trades and technical pursuits which are sometimes classified by usage under that name. The term engineering has come to be known or come to be applied to engineering trades, and the vision of an engineer in the minds of many people is a man with essentially dirty hands and wearing a pair of greasy overalls. But there are engineers who are not like that, and it's the professional engineer about whom I'm to speak this evening. But before talking of the future of engineering, I feel I should at least define my subject so that at least we can proceed on common ground. Engineering was defined a little over 100 years ago by Thomas Tredgold as being the art of directing the great sources of power in nature for the use and convenience of man. It isn't easy to define a profession or calling in precise terms, but Tredgold's definition has withstood the test of time and of usage, and probably comes as close to the mark as possible. If we accept his definition, it is immediately apparent that engineering is not static, but must adapt itself to change, both in the available sources of power in nature and in the needs of man. It is in the consideration of these changes and their interrelation which brings predictions of the future into some sort of order. It also makes it clear that the engineer can't go it alone. He may be able to solve material problems of the world with the greatest skill, but can he be sure that they're the right problems? Furthermore, even if the problems are stated correctly, can he be sure that he's made the right assumptions? I can perhaps best illustrate this point by repeating the story told by Bowden, at least the question asked by Bowden, who asks, if a boy aged 20 can pick 10 pounds of blackberries in a day, and a girl aged 18 can pick 9 pounds of blackberries in a day, how many will they both pick together? Bowden's answer is, it all depends, but probably not very many. An engineer or other scientist can undoubtedly find an answer to this kind of question, but there's always the chance that it'll be the wrong answer, or perhaps the right answer to the wrong question. It's for this reason that the education of an engineer can never be completed at a university. He requires the wisdom that's born of experience before he can view his profession in the right perspective. And finally, before returning to my main subject, there is inherent in this evening's topic what a mathematician tends to call an existence theorem. Will there even be such a thing as engineering in the next 50 years? Will it be swallowed up by pure science, like a mother eating her young? It's my belief that there will be a profession of engineering in 50 years' time, and that it will continue to thrive in very happy association with pure science. But there is, and there always has been, a very clear line of distinction between the pure scientist and the engineer. The scientist is interested essentially in analysis, the examination of the phenomena of nature, and the quest for increased knowledge of things around him. If he discovers why grass is green, or what goes on inside an atom, or how the earth acquired its shape, then he has enriched the world with new knowledge, and this is a worthy end in itself. The engineer, on the other hand, assimilates the knowledge gained from pure scientific research and applies it by a process of synthesis to the objectives stated by Treadgold. The difference can best be illustrated by the derivation of the two words. Science is derived from the Latin scio, I know. The engineer comes from ingenium, which means human capacity and invention. And I think that is perhaps as good a definition of the difference as can be given. This distinction isn't confined, in my opinion, to what is nowadays regarded as science. I believe that it is of equal validity in the arts and in the humanities. Classics, history, archaeology, these are all analytic processes. They involve the search for knowledge as an end in itself. The social sciences, so economics and law, are basically synthetic. Philosophy perhaps lies somewhere between them. I would suggest for your consideration that the modern concept of strife between the two cultures, the sciences and the humanities, should be forgotten very quickly as a bad dream. And instead, it should be replaced by a new concept of two cultures, the two cultures of analysis and synthesis, between that which there's no strife at all, but only the closest of mutual dependence. Now, having attempted very briefly to define engineering and to describe its relationship to science as well as other studies, I'll now return to the more difficult task of prediction. The engineer's business is synthesis, and he's concerned first with defining his objective and then with finding the means of gaining it. The ultimate objectives facing him are derived from Treadgold's definition, to direct the great sources of power in nature for the use and convenience of man. If we examine the needs of man in the present rather tumultuous world, we find there are two basic obstacles in the way of human progress. On the spiritual and ethical planes, there is the absence of mutual trust and understanding between peoples of the world. And on the material plane, there is the unequal distribution of the world's resources, particularly of food, in relation to the distribution of population. And these are the two needs with which we are faced. It's both facile and false to assert, as is so often done, that the spiritual obstacle calls for the attention of the humanist, while the material obstacle requires treatment by the scientist and technologist. The two cannot be separated. It just isn't as easy as that. I suggest to you that both of these problems come naturally under the single heading of communications. I'm talking of communications in the broadest possible sense, communications between people and places, between the past, the present, and the future, communications of people, of material, of power, and ideas and information. This, to my mind, is our main objection, the improvement of communications, and it's in this light that I want to examine the future of engineering. Some of you may have read, as I did a week or two ago, a press report, presumably a correct report, of my colleague Dean Chant having criticized the modern use of words as an expedient and as an alternative to thought, and he mentioned communications as one of these words. I'd like to say that I agree with every word he said or is reported to have said, and I agree also that words such as communications are frequently used as an excuse to avoid deep thinking. But what I want, or what I hope to do tonight, is to point out that this word communication covers a great deal of thinking that has gone on in the past and will go on in the future. In the time available, all I can do is to select a few of the probable fields in which the engineer is likely to play his part during the next 50 years. The areas I've chosen are these: the transport of men and materials, the distribution of sources of power, the effective use of materials, and the communication of information. These are the four regions of communication which I've attempted to cover, or I am attempting to cover this evening. In each case, I intend to talk a little about the kind of research and development that's going on and has gone on in the past, and see if I can project this by some form of extrapolation into the future. Although I've had to limit my own remarks to these three or four areas, I hope that you will have both the time and energy later to extend the discussion into wider fields. So first, let us have a look at the communication of men and materials. The most striking development in the recent past has been the increased speed of transport. It isn't so long since the fastest possible human speed was the speed of a galloping horse, roughly 30 miles an hour. I well remember being told only about a little over 20 years ago by a most prominent aeronautical engineer that speeds beyond about 3/4 the speed of sound, in other words, 500 or 600 miles an hour, were physically unattainable as a continued motion. Sustained flight could not occur at those high speeds. And yet, already the sound barrier has been broken, it's been taken by storm, and the advance guard has moved a very long way into the plains beyond. Leaving aside any consideration of interplanetary travel and missiles and this class of thing, how far will this quest for speed continue? The limit must occur somewhere. And it's my belief that the limit of human travel, the limit of speed of human travel, is going to be determined by the limit of human physiology. The comfort of travel is determined not by speed, but by acceleration. I think I can illustrate that to all of you by reminding you of what happens when you step into an elevator. When the thing suddenly starts to go down or starts to go up, you have an uncomfortable feeling, depending on what you've had for dinner, and this feeling continues while the elevator is accelerating. The moment it gets into a steady speed, you have no sense whatever of motion. So this acceleration is the limiting factor. So if we take an upper limit of reasonably endurable human transport, of an acceleration, a forward acceleration, equal to that due to gravity. Now that would be rather uncomfortable over a long period, but if we take that as the upper limit, then it would be theoretically possible to travel from here to the Antipodes, which means to any part of the world, in something under an hour. Now, this would involve reaching a speed of between 30 and 40,000 miles an hour, halfway to the objective, and then putting on the brakes and suffering a retardation equal to the initial acceleration. Now, this is pretty fast travel. It means transport from any point to any other point of the globe in an hour or less. Well, now, is there any point in aiming for these speeds when it takes considerably longer to travel to one's final objective or from one's initial source at the two ends? This is one of the difficulties. There are technical difficulties associated with this, of course. If we get into an aircraft that starts to travel at this sort of speed, 30 or 40,000 miles an hour, it only needs a slight maladjustment or a slight error on the part of the pilot, and we simply go into orbit. And the and the flight becomes rather longer than we'd expected, and our descent rather more hazardous. Now, we have already reached the stage, even with a comparatively slow travel at this mere 600 or 700 miles an hour, where the advantages of air travel are very greatly offset by the time spent at each end of the trip getting to and from the aircraft. So that the major engineering problem is likely to occur at the two ends. I'm not belittling the problems of high-speed flight, there are plenty of them, but recent satellite research has shown that these problems are likely to be overcome, and there's every likelihood that this sort of speed is attainable. So the big problem is more likely to be that of rapid transit at the two ends. And a very attractive proposition, if it ever comes about, is simply the pneumatic tube, the old-fashioned thing that was used to fire bills about in a department store from one end to the other. If passengers can be taken out of an aircraft in a rollout, possibly in a tube, put into a cylinder, pushed into a pneumatic tube, they can go at an enormous speed to the centre of a city with comparatively little discomfort and arrive refreshed when they get there. Also, even if we assume that our long journeys will be made mainly in space, there is always the doubt whether we can get there and back safely without being bombarded with cosmic rays or these other objectionable particles. So there are a number of uncertainties in the future of high-speed travel. But one thing I think we can say is certain, and this is where all engineers are going to be concerned, there will be very much faster travel, and there will be very much faster transport at the ends. These, I think, become essential. If we content ourselves with rather slower flight, as we'll probably have to do, maybe if we're satisfied with a period of 2 or 3 hours to get to any other part of the Earth's surface, the terminal problem is still there. One possibility, which has already been achieved on a moderate scale, is that of vertical takeoff and landing. The advantages of doing this are obvious, but so are the problems. The problems of noise in the middle of a city and noxious fumes and so on. Now I'd like, in the slide, to show you a vision of things to come. Is that reasonably visible? I don't think it's quite in focus. Is that visible at the back? A lot of research in flight nowadays is carried out, at supersonic speeds, supersonic wind tunnels, and phenomena are examined by what is known as Schlieren photography, and it's possible to photograph shock waves and the like. This is typical of the sort of research that is going on in aeronautical departments. That is, in fact, the Velvet Glove missile. It has particular relevance because it was designed in this country. And I've shown that slide to show the sort of the shape of things to come, the sort of research which, in a few years' time, is going to be practical reality. Now, this also helps to show the shape of things to come. The Coleoptera, a French device designed for vertical takeoff. I don't know quite how the pilot sits in his seat. He must be very uncomfortable when he takes off there. But there it is. Well, now... Oh, it works. The future of rapid transport is likely to be determined partly by these engineering problems, but also, and probably more so, by considerations of reliability and economics, rather than the solution of the technical difficulties. At first sight, the cost of increased speed appears to be an obstacle to progress, but this isn't necessarily the case, because as the speed of an aircraft increases, so the journey, the length of time spent on a journey decreases, the number of journeys per day increases, and therefore the payload increases. And modern aircraft operators know that they must have faster aircraft to remain competitive. The question whether or not passengers want the higher speeds may not even be relevant. Now, I'll come now to the second of my predictions, and this is in relation to the distribution of power resources. The development of populations throughout the world has rarely followed the distribution of the world's resources other than the supply of water. Populations have always headed for water, but they have rarely headed for other sources of supply. The Industrial Revolution of the last century placed much greater emphasis on the supply of fuels and certain raw materials, but in spite of this, the difference between populations and raw materials exists, and the bulk of the world's shipping is still concerned with the transportation of fuel and of raw materials. There is no reason at all to expect any substantial change in this situation, and in fact the modern trend of populations is to centralize, to drift towards the major cities, which is a natural result of the increasing efficiency of farming and mining operations through mechanization. The communication of material resources is a problem which will always be with us. On the other hand, a large proportion of the Earth's surface is at present wasteland, while the remainder is becoming overcrowded. Recent research in land utilization has shown that a great deal of wasteland can be made highly productive. But an essential requirement is the availability of power. There are practical limits to the distribution of power, particularly, strangely enough, of electrical power. And it's even with some of the modern developments that have gone on in countries such as Sweden and the USSR, in general, it can be said that electric power cannot conveniently and economically be distributed over a range of more than perhaps a few hundred miles. It's this lack of adequate power resources within reasonable range which discourages the development of many regions of the world. Many of them are in parched areas where water is scarce, and power is needed to bring water to the area or even to distill seawater. Yet in these areas, the amount of energy being received from the sun on 1 square mile, as little an area as 1 square mile of, say, desert land, is roughly equal to the whole proposed output of the Columbia River system. The power is there. It's a question of how it's to be used. Now, this is one of the great sources of power in nature which must be and will be directed for the use and convenience of man. Early attempts to make use of solar energy were based on concentration of the sun's rays into a limited region so that they could be used as a direct source of heat. There are already a number of successful applications of this method, apart, of course, from the natural processes of living matter, which, of course, have been applying this method of obtaining power for many centuries and for the whole of the present geological era. The commercial production of salt from seawater, various drying processes, storage of water heated by the sun in summer to heat houses and buildings in winter are specific examples. But in general, these processes require a great deal of space, and a large space usually involves heavy and cumbersome plant and very expensive plant to tie it together. If the energy of the sun can be concentrated in a form other than direct heat, many of these mechanical problems resulting from the large area concerned can be partly overcome. The possibility of direct conversion of heat into electricity on a large scale has been for many years in the minds of engineers. But until recently, its economic conversion has been just out of reach. Recent developments in semiconductors have altered the situation quite drastically, and it may well be that our present picture of a thermal power station with its furnaces, its boilers, its rotating machinery may become a thing of the past, or at any rate, it may be partially replaced by some form of solar power station, suitable for remote areas in particular. There are still many technical difficulties, but in spite of them, the prospect of converting low-grade heat, low-temperature heat, economically into electric power is an alluring one which holds tremendous hope for the development of the less promising areas of the world. Now, I want to go back a little in history. The origin of this new hope did not lie in a mass attack on these problems of power production. Certainly, such an attack has been made, but the origin of the new hope lies in careful, very often unspectacular research work of people who have been interested in the materials known as semiconductors. These form an intermediate class between the electrical conductors, like aluminium and copper, and the electrical insulators, like porcelain or mica or glass. Many years of mathematical, physical, and chemical studies have brought forth some rather remarkable properties of these materials. To take one important example, the metal germanium, in an extremely pure state, can be formed into a very even and symmetrical crystalline structure, the sort of structure that could be illustrated, just schematically, by a mass of billiard balls all packed together into a very tight corner within a confined area. They give a symmetrical structure, and a glance at the structure shows that it's symmetrical. Now, if a minute amount of an impurity, and referring again to germanium, if an impurity such as indium or antimony be added, just in a tiny quantity, perhaps one part in 100 million, the properties of the mass are quite profoundly altered. It's rather like the effect, in my billiard ball analogy, of replacing one or two of the billiard balls by a ball of a slightly different size. You see lines of cleavage appearing. Many of you may have had the occasion to pack apples or oranges or fruit of some kind into a box. And if these things are the right size and they're all of the same size, they pack neatly and they fit into alternate rows and you get a very nice structure. But it only needs one or two to be the wrong shape or the wrong size, and you find it extremely difficult to get an orderly sequence. Now, the effect of the change is not limited to the region immediately surrounding the disturbance, but it is surprisingly widespread, and these planes of cleavage spread over a wide distance. Now, I want to illustrate this point with a few slides. That is not a collection of billiard balls. It's a much more convenient technique has been developed by physicists. They simply blow bubbles, bubbles of a uniform size, and these form themselves into a very neat pattern, as you can see. And looking head on at that pattern, it probably looks to you very symmetrical. Unfortunately, I can't turn this screen at an angle, but there are one or two bubbles near the center which are different in size. And I can see, because I'm looking at this at an acute angle, but you can't see head on, that there's a very distinct break in the symmetry of this pattern. It changes quite dramatically in the center. And it's unfortunate that there seems no way of showing this sort of slide edge on to an audience. But if we laid a ruler across some of these lines, these diagonal lines, it would be seen immediately that the order has been disturbed over quite a wide area. This is illustrated schematically in this way. You have to upset the symmetry of the packing when you get an odd molecule or an odd particle in the wrong place. Now, the patterns formed by these dislocation phenomena, as they're known, are rather extraordinary. At first, one would think they were quite random and hard to examine. But in fact, they do follow various patterns. And I'll show you a slide. It's not a very easy slide to follow. But you can see this is illustrative of the spiral growth of some of these dislocation phenomena. You can see it's an orderly form of disorder. Now, It may be well to interpolate here that the behavior of material of this kind has much in common with human behavior in the mass. It is perhaps related to the fact that the murder of a European archduke started a world war, or that a World Cup game in New York has started a brawl in Chicago. Many patterns followed by molecules are very similar to human patterns. This spreading of dislocation phenomena, as they're called, is of importance in several ways. It affects the mechanical strength of metals, and I'm going to refer to that later, and it also determines the electrical behavior of semiconductors. It has been a long haul from the theoretical and experimental examination of dislocation phenomena to the conversion of solar heat into electrical energy. And there is still a long way to go before the sun can be seriously regarded as part of our organized power system. I have no doubt that this will come about in the reasonably near future. The story of the semiconductor and its practical application illustrates very well the value of interplay between pure science and engineering, between analysis and synthesis. The curiosity of the scientist revealed some of the secrets of the semiconductor. The skill of the engineer produced the transistor and the consequential nuisance of portable radios. And as the scientist discovered more facts, the engineer used them in extending the range of transistor devices. This in turn stimulated and facilitated further research and discovery by the physicist. And as more properties were revealed, so they were put to use. And it was not long before the solar cell began to look more like a prospective large-scale source of power than a mere pipe dream. The economic use of solar power then position in other countries, the advantages of nuclear fission have still to be established. And to estimate its economic development in the next 50 years wouldn't be profitable at the present time because of uncertainty as to the next step. On any blueprint, to use this objectionable and misapplied word, for the development of the fission process, there is always a very large question mark. What of nuclear fusion? Because power can be extracted from the atom in two basic ways. It can be extracted by breaking a heavy nucleus, a nucleus of uranium or the like, into two roughly equal parts. That releases power. Or power can be released by sticking together one or two atoms of the lighter elements, such as hydrogen or deuterium. This process is known as fusion as opposed to fission. The use of hydrogen rather than uranium has obvious and tremendous advantages. But the step from a hydrogen bomb to a controlled fusion reaction appears to be a far more difficult one to achieve than the step from the uranium bomb to the fission, controlled fission process, which has already been achieved. The study of plasma physics is now being followed intensively all over the world, and the power engineer of the future must be ready to play his part in assessing and developing any new discovery in this area, which is likely to bring the controlled fusion of light elements into the realm of economic power production. From power, let me turn now to the distribution and use of materials, because this is another problem of communication. I don't need to stress that mankind has been in the past, and still is, extremely prodigal in the use of materials, and especially those materials that are mined or quarried from the earth. Unlike vegetable matter, few of our mineral resources can be regenerated or replaced after removal, and we are already at the stage where the gap between reserves and expected needs is alarmingly small in some commodities. One solution to this problem, of course, is the human one of requiring more human discipline. But a great deal can be done by using materials to better advantage and therefore more economically. It's now possible to determine theoretically the ideal strength of metals, such as copper, or iron, or steel, and it's known that the actual tensile strength of these materials in practice falls short of the calculated value, not by a small margin, but by a factor of 1,000 to 2,000. In other words, a lump of steel, a bit of steel used in a bridge, is by a factor of 1,000 or more weaker than theoretically it could be. This results primarily from the phenomena which I've already described in dealing with semiconductors, the dislocation phenomena. If the ideal strength could be realized, structures could be made a great deal lighter. New light has been thrown on this problem by the fairly recent discovery that metals, under certain conditions, can grow whiskers. This seemingly trivial discovery would have led nowhere but for the curiosity of scientists who wanted to know more about these metal whiskers. What caused them, what they were, how they could be produced. It was soon found that they could be produced in a laboratory by the reduction of metal halides or by other chemical processes, or even physically by the compression of pure metals. If you have a pure metal, it's possible to squeeze whiskers out of it. An examination of the physical properties of whiskers has shown that they contain very few dislocations and that their tensile strength comes fairly close to the calculated value, which is 1,000 to 2,000 times as strong as the metal in the bulk. There's a photograph of a whisker. To give the scale, this is 10 microns, a micron being a millionth of a meter. So about 25,000 microns make an inch. So this would be rather thinner than a human hair. I'm not sure what metal that is, but you can see it's developed along some rather symmetrical crystalline structure. This is a curve provided by the metallurgy department in this university, showing the result of many observations getting closer and closer to a curve, which show that the strength, the yield strength of the material, will go up very steeply as the size of the whisker decreases. These figures are in microns, 4 microns, and it's perfectly clear from this that the dislocation phenomena have a vast effect on the strength of the material. I'm afraid I can't show you a suitable photograph of whiskers growing on a metal, because if there's enough metal to see, then the whiskers are too small to see in a picture. Is it possible to produce a metal in bulk with properties that approach those of the metal whisker? Scientists and engineers will be asking this question more and more insistently in the coming years. Even if a gain in strength of 1,000 or more is found unattainable, a gain of even 2 or 3 would have a very significant effect on the efficient use of structural metals and therefore on the economy of their application. Now, I shall not attempt to describe the many other areas of research which could lead to improvements in the use of the materials at our disposal. There are so many of them that I've chosen just to take one instance. But I'll move on now to my fourth prediction, and this relates to the future communication of information and ideas. Possibly the most exciting developments in the immediate future in this field will come from new concepts in the field of electrical communications. We've become so accustomed to the use of such mundane things as the telephone that the everyday extension and enlargement and improvement of telephone services passes almost unnoticed. And yet a tremendous lot is happening. The reliability of wired telephony can hardly be challenged. And for many years to come, the telephone networks of the world will be expanded and will be integrated. Within the next few years, the world will be completely encircled by a telephone cable, and direct dialing from one place to the other will soon become universal rather than purely regional. In the meantime, in the field of radio communication, the idea of surrounding the Earth by a cloud of satellites to form an artificial and reliable ionosphere for the reflection of radio signals no longer seems impracticable. And of course, it's the ionosphere which makes long distance transmission of radio possible. Communication signals have already been bounced off satellites, so it looks as if the major problems have been overcome. However, more fundamental significance must be attached to the basic theory of communications, which is known nowadays as information theory. This is a field in which the engineer and the mathematician, and a number of others, incidentally, share common ground. The philosophical concept of information as a measurable quantity has not only opened up new scientific approaches to problems of the communication of ideas, but has also already led to very practical results in the design of communication systems. To the radio engineer, space is, in a sense, an expendable commodity. Every channel of communication needs space in the frequency spectrum, and space is in short supply nowadays. What there is must be used efficiently, and modern systems must be designed accordingly. This is a continuing job for the engineer. Associated with the theoretical advances resulting from the application of information theory, there is another important factor of a more direct practical nature. That is the development of the modern computing machine. It is well known that these machines can perform prodigious feats of mathematics in an incredibly short time and still have the energy to play chess or compose music in their spare time. Let me give you an illustration. That is music composed by a computing machine. It's entitled Push Button Bertha. The material for this slide was given to me by Dr. Hull, who's in the audience. I don't know whether he could be persuaded later on to sing the song to us, but at least I'd like to thank him for presenting me, or at least giving me the material. Now, Dr. Hiller of the University of Illinois was asked fairly recently what contribution to the social well-being of the world computing machines were making. And he, without committing himself as to the contributions they were making, he did suggest that a future contribution could be made if a computing machine was set to compose every conceivable and possible form of music which could be classified as rock and roll, and that when these tunes, so-called, were completed, they should all be copyrighted so that nobody else could use them, and then they should be locked away so that nobody could get at them. The machine's ability to indulge in these harmless pastimes is not as trivial a matter as it appears on the surface, because it illustrates a property of the computing machine which to my mind will be far more significant than its mathematical erudition when we're considering its future influence on the human race. Mathematically, the computing machine does little more than simple arithmetic. Its value lies in its ability not only to do its arithmetic very quickly, but also to carry out thousands or even millions or thousands of millions of operations without reference to its human operator or master. It can even, to a limited but surprising extent, make its own decisions as to what to do next. The important point is that it can work in the same way with logical as well as with arithmetic operations. The game of chess, composing a composition of music, are good illustrations, but they're illustrations only. A great deal of the world's business is carried on through decisions based on the assessment of large numbers of data. This has become a much more scientific process in recent years. The process of linear programming has been applied to it, and a machine can do the necessary processing of information very quickly and very accurately, whereas a human being could not conceivably in his own lifetime carry out some of these manipulations. In brief, what the computing machine will do in replacing routine mental labor is akin to what mechanization has already done to replace routine manual labor. It is no exaggeration to state that just as the steam engine ushered in what is now known as the Industrial Revolution, so the computing machine has given rise to the second Industrial Revolution in which we're all now involved. And I believe that the social and economic effects of the computing machine will be shown by history to be just as great as those of the discovery and invention of the steam engine. It's hard to visualize at present what social events this revolution will have. We have at least the advantage nowadays that education is far more widespread than when the steam engine was first produced. Less people are willing to spend their lives in the more objectionable or menial tasks, and this is as true now of mental as of manual tasks. It may well be that the rapid spread of education throughout the world has in fact created the environment in which the new revolution will prosper without any of the tragedies and disasters which accompanied the growth of the first industrial revolution. I can't miss the opportunity of using the dramatic development of the computing machine to stress again the value of cooperation between the mathematician and scientist, the analyst on one hand, and the engineer or synthesist on the other. Although the computing machine is generally regarded as a modern invention, mechanical aids to computation are a very ancient concept. The use of the Chinese abacus, of course, is as old as history, and other devices have been used over the years. But the basic ideas of the modern machine, even of this modern electronic brain that we hear so much about, they were described in full more than 100 years ago by Charles Babbage. To my mind, Charles Babbage has made a contribution which history will show to be just as great as that of James Watt. He is very little known, and I feel you should all have a look at him. Yes, you're quite right, he was a cranky old boy. In fact, that is perhaps one of the reasons why he isn't well known. He fought with everybody he had to deal with and had great trouble getting support for his work. But that doesn't belittle his work in any way. Babbage was appointed quite an early age to the Lucasian Chair of Mathematics at the University of Cambridge. He occupied the chair for 11 years, I believe, and during that time he didn't give a single lecture. I haven't heard of any similar jobs going at the University of British Columbia, but I think they should be very much sought after. Babbage was a mathematician with considerable engineering insight, who visualized the practical use that could be made of a machine that could do simple arithmetic quickly and accurately without having to wait at every stage to be told what to do next. He went so far as to make a mechanical model incorporating his ideas. But these ideas lay dormant for the best part of a century, mainly because engineering hadn't quite caught up with him. The development of radar during the Second World War provided the techniques that Babbage needed or would have needed if he'd lived till that time, and so the electronic computer was born. Perhaps I should show you, before leaving Babbage, show you his idea of a computer. This represents something which in a modern machine would occupy a very small section of one corner of the machine. But this was a mechanical device. It was full of gear wheels, registers, dials and things that went round and round. But basically, he had all the concepts of the modern computing machine. And it's only because he had to deal with all this heavy material rather than electrons that he didn't make a great deal of further progress in his lifetime. As I say, engineering hadn't caught up with him. Another very interesting fact about Babbage is that none of his writings, or practically none of his writings on technical matters, were of very much value. He wrote very little in description of his work, and what we know of him came mainly from the writings of the daughter of Lord Byron, the Countess of Lovelace. But strangely enough, Babbage wrote most of his work on theological subjects. And in fact, it was the interplay of ideas, his scientific or mathematical ideas with his theological ideas, which acted as stimulation to both. Now, as I repeat, that Babbage had all the ideas, but the techniques were just not there. And it wasn't until about the middle of the last World War that electronic techniques of the right kind became available. And when they did become available, everything went ahead very fast. The first electronic computer appeared a few years after the beginning of the last war. And since that time, the ball has been tossed backwards and forwards between the mathematician, the physicist, and the engineer. New demands are being created, and new methods are being found to meet them. New devices are invented and new demands are discovered to make use of them. Parkinson's law again. This is scientific development at its very best and is indicative of how engineering will make its most rapid progress in the future. Communication between people is carried out at present mainly through the printed word. It's probably true to say that until recently, the most important contribution ever to be made to communications was the invention of the printing press. However, one cannot now overlook the remarkable properties of the devices which go to make up a computing machine, particularly the storage facility and the means of gaining rapid access to it. Information stores in electrical form can be transmitted to any part of the world in a very short time. It may very well prove both economical and effective to replace part of the vast store of literature held in the libraries of the world by modern electrical storage devices. Perhaps molecular storage is not too much to hope for, together with a communication network to link up the facilities of all such libraries. Now, before leaving this subject, let me refer briefly to another application of the computing machine, that is the automatic translation of language. Since I'm limited to the next 50 years, this may be perhaps a little bit out of order. However, some progress has been made. The surface has been scratched, and minor feats of translation have in fact been mechanically achieved. Now, it'd be pointless to belittle the difficulties in achieving translation from one language to another. Even if vocabularies and syntax and grammar could all be handled, you still have the problems of idiom, of dialect, and so on. And this appears at first to be an almost insuperable problem. Just to give an example of this, which might illustrate the point very well, a machine was set up to do a bit of translating from English into Russian, and it was given an English proverb to translate. Proverb was, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. The final translation, translated back again into English, was that the vodka is passable, but the meat stinks. And you can see the sort of difficulties which occur in setting up a translation, that's translating machine, which can reliably handle the idiomatic use of language. There is, on a more scientific plane, there is the machine which kept on translating something as water goat, and eventually it was discovered this meant hydraulic ram. Now these are... these are obvious difficulties, and the means of overcoming them are not nearly so obvious. But philologists and others are working on this problem, and I don't believe that effective automatic translation need be so far away as many people believe. In any case, here is a chance for the humanist and the engineer really to get together with a common purpose. Now, this is all I want to say about past and present research and their likely effect on the future of engineering, and I'd like to go now to a slightly more general topic. I've talked only about some of the new and glamorous aspects of engineering of the future. In doing this, I've had to exclude many other activities which may be at least as important and even more so. In particular, I've so far failed to mention the continuation and extension of present engineering practices. Roads will still have to be built. Land will have to be irrigated. Industry and homes will have to be provided with power and materials. Superhighways and supermarkets will become super colossal highways and super stupendous markets. And the mere fact of growth will make demands on the ingenuity, which by definition is the prime attribute of engineering. However, to do reasonable justice to these matters would require not one lecture, but a very long course. Let me simply say that the duty of engineering to the community is such that the provision of material services will always remain the core of the profession. And if I paid little attention to it this evening, it's only because of my inability to do that in a limited time. I'd like to conclude my talk by referring once again to Treadgold's definition, the art of directing the great sources of power in nature. I had occasion recently to take part in a symposium in Montreal on a subject similar to the one we're discussing this evening. The delegates were at one stage addressed by a guest speaker, Dr. Carl Stern, a well-known psychiatrist. We were an audience of engineers, and our ego was considerably inflated by his opening remarks that he had never had an engineer as a patient. But he went on to analyze the reasons for this, and he eventually found that the The real reason was that most engineers just couldn't afford a psychiatrist. But apart from this, he impressed us all tremendously by his systematic tracing of man's psychological environment through the centuries. In particular, he pointed out that earlier civilizations accepted as an inevitable background to their existence the rhythm of nature. The seasons, the weekly, the diurnal variations were accepted without question, and man adapted himself to it. But later generations, particularly since the invention of the steam engine, have attempted to control nature to an increasing extent. And Dr. Stern attributed to this change the growth of human tensions and uncertainties, which in turn have led to psychological irregularities in increasing numbers of individuals, many of whom now find their way to the psychiatrist's consulting room. It would be hard to deny the truth of this statement, even though we have little knowledge of the psychiatric state of earlier civilizations. However, the quality of ingenuity, which is by definition the basic attribute of engineering, is one of which the engineer does not claim or attempt to claim a monopoly. It's present in some degree in all of us. And we shall always attempt to improve our environment. And if this means directing or redirecting the sources of power in nature, then they will be directed or redirected. We may be making for ourselves an uncomfortable psychological bed on which to lie, but the process will continue. It is the task of engineering in the coming years to see that it progresses in an orderly way for the use and convenience of man. Now, there have been many suggestions in recent years, particularly since the efforts of engineers have very often led to devastating devices such as atomic bombs and so on. It has been suggested many times that scientific and engineering progress should be stopped dead in their tracks. And this has seriously been put up as a criticism of engineers, or at least as a solution to some of our future problems. Now, I find it hard to believe that any enlightened people would think that way. And if, by any chance, I'm saying the wrong thing, and if any member of the audience doesn't agree with me, I'd like, in conclusion, to refer him to the final slide, which I have here. You women always want something new. We got fire and the wheel. There's nothing more left for invention.
It's normal practice at the Vancouver Institute to not only expect our guests to deliver an address, but also to answer questions that might be put to him from the audience. And so I'm now in the position of being ready to relay your questions to Dean Myers. Has he baffled you all with science? One over here.
Mr. Chairman, the speaker partially answered the question that I had in mind, but I'd like to have it carried a little further if possible. There seems to be a general feeling among scientists that the future advance of science and engineering will depend to a very large degree on the moral development of the human being. Now, the general feeling is that the individual today hasn't learned to control himself. So how can he ever learn to control the forces that have been put at our command?
Did everybody hear that question? Rather long one.
Very good, though.
Would you like to tackle it?
I'm afraid I don't know the answer to this. It's essentially a moral or an ethical question. But I wonder whether this is anything which is within our ordinary power, within the power of governments, within the power of engineers or physicists to tackle adequately. Nobody would dispute that an improvement in the moral tone of the community is needed if we're to make the best use of what is available to us. must we always have the best? We can always aim at the best. Presumably we should aim at the best use of our facilities. But I wonder myself whether there has been any real change in our moral attitude. To my mind, the development of science over the centuries, and of course this is, I suppose, a matter for a historian rather than an engineer to judge, but to my mind this has created or has been accompanied by an improvement in the moral standard. After all, nowadays, by contrast with not so many centuries ago, if somebody has something you want, you don't immediately set out to kill him. There are differences in attitude. Perhaps people have become less aggressive. They may have become more silently aggressive and more subtly aggressive. But generally, I believe myself that with increased facilities has gone increased education, and with increased education has gone a higher moral tone. Now, I may be quite wrong, and I'm afraid I'm not really competent to answer your question. I've simply given my opinion.
Yes, Mr. Bartholomew.
Chairman, I should like to ask the speaker to review the general progress of science and engineering, not as we have seen it in the past 50 years only, but to carry us back century and centuries. And I should like to suggest, sir, that engineering will approach, and science, a saturation condition. If I can illustrate this in the field in which I have been active, we have seen enormous growth in the rate of electricity usage throughout the world. Yet, on this continent today, we are forecasting slower rates of growth, and the authorities are talking about an approach to a saturation condition. And I am wondering whether science and engineering are not bound to approach a line to which it is attitudinous.
They're baffling me with long questions, which I can't repeat. So again, I hope that you all heard the question.
I think there's a great deal of truth in the implication of that question. First of all, the growth of civilization has been going up at a logarithmic rate. Now, this just cannot go on forever. Sir Charles Darwin predicted quite recently that in a measurable number of years, I've forgotten how many, there would be standing room only on the Earth. And this obviously cannot happen. This occurs in many other natural growth problems. Problem of plagues, the host and parasite problem, so beloved of biologists, is a case in point. You don't get logarithmic growth going on indefinitely because there's always some counteracting force which puts a stop to it and usually starts things going the other way. So the natural phenomena of this kind are oscillatory. They just go up and down rather than follow some fixed path. And this happens in many controlled systems as well. But for this very reason, the first part of the question becomes, I think, a little irrelevant, because to go back in history as a means of predicting becomes quite impossible. You can't predict by looking backwards what's happening to an oscillatory function. I quite agree that some sort of stock should be taken periodically as to where we're heading, because the growth of electric power production, the growth of developments, industrial developments of all kind, cannot just go on indefinitely till everybody is producing so much. Some sort of form of development. But there are so many outside forces acting on this that it isn't a natural growth problem, such as a population problem, which can very often be predicted. Even the oscillations can be predicted. The problem is a difficult one, but I quite agree it's something from which we shouldn't shy away.
Another question up here.
My question concerned a slightly different restriction on the rate of local engineering. And this arises out of our speaker's emphasis that the processes of analysis and synthesis should cooperate. Now, about a year ago, in this room, at a meeting of the Vancouver Institute, one panel member stated it as his considered opinion that engineering had no place in the university. That person was concerned with a department traditionally associated with analysis. And it was interesting that this remark produced applause from the audience at that time. I therefore wonder if our speaker feels there is going to be any resistance to the development of engineering because of social concerns, considerations, or does he feel that the natural sloth and greed of man will always result in the engineer having his head?
I don't know quite how to answer that one. I feel before I do it, I should go outside and put on my red sweater with the two white bands around the sleeve. But I think perhaps this remark that was referred to was an inspired remark intended to provoke discussion. I can't believe that it was really intended seriously. But if it was, well, I'm afraid this is just a matter of opinion which there can be no resolution. But as far as I'm concerned, I just have always refused to see any basic difference between the sciences and the humanities, for that matter, and engineering and the social sciences, other than this difference of analysis and synthesis. And I wouldn't like to suggest for a moment that one of them is more important or better than the other. I think they are all part and parcel of our life, and it's something which we all need. I think a diet of caviar would be very bad if we had no porridge to go with it.
I was going to ask which was the caviar and which was the porridge.
I'm announcing it.
Could you speak up just a little so everybody can hear you?
I'd like to ask a question on this subject of communication, and in particular, this question about the translation of one language to another. And it occurs to me that perhaps the speaker would have some ideas on the way our language could perhaps change to facilitate this problem, and in particular, perhaps how our language could change or could improve our alphabet, for argument's sake, to improve, to get around this massive words we see every day, to convey the same amount of information.
In other words, will the scientist attack the humanist?
There's a simple answer to that, and that is that we should all learn Esperanto. Now, that has been attempted and it's failed. I think human nature is against it. And I think we'll always have this problem of translating from one language to another. There are questions of national pride and racial pride, which seem to me to be too difficult to overcome by asking any wide section of the community to adopt a common language. But if we accept that, there is still the problem of translation. I think I've stressed already the difficulties attendant on it, the difficulties of translation of idiom, the ambiguity of words, ambiguities of pronunciation, and so on. All these things add to the difficulty of translating. And I don't think any scheme based purely on vocabulary and literal translation is ever likely to be more than partially successful. Now, this is a matter, I think, where the philologists come into the scene, the people who make it their business to study language. And they are doing this. I attended a lecture some 3 or 4 years ago by an English scholar who was, I think, one of the few pioneers in this field. And he gave a lecture explaining the literature of ideas, the actual, the language, I should say, of ideas. And he made a very careful philosophical analysis of the English language, and I had to confess it was completely over my head. I just didn't understand a word of it. Now, I think in the translation of language, we must have some common ground in the languages, something which is independent of idiom, independent of dialect, independent of word order, but simply a statement, a symbolic statement of ideas. Now, just how that can be achieved, I just don't know, and that's why I suggested that the subject might be a little out of order this evening, because I'm talking about the next 50 years. But if there are any philologists in the audience, perhaps they could give a better answer to this question.
Might I ask a practical question? Dr. Myers has told us that at the present time, electricity can only be transported economically over a very few hundred miles. I happened to be in the town of Fort St. John last summer when some financiers from Scotland, among other countries, were studying the question of development of power in the Peace River. And in view of the fact that the head of one of the Scottish banks seemed to be interested in developing power up there, is the question of the transportation of power nearer solution than perhaps we think?
I thought perhaps that I'd made my remarks so brief that they could have been slightly misunderstood. The transportation of power from one point to another over a long distance is practicable. In Sweden, where there's hydropower in vast quantities in the north and industry in a considerable scale in the south, some 700 to 800 miles away, it has been done, and done very successfully. In the USSR, where the question arises of transferring huge blocks of power from Moscow to Stalingrad or whatever it may be, arise. There you're dealing with a large wholesale transfer of power, and there are present practical limits which will be overcome. There are new devices, new methods being used, the use of direct current rather than alternating current, which will probably extend the range. But that is never likely to become economical for comparatively small blocks of power, well, I say comparatively small, such as could be used to develop a few hundred square miles of desert area. Now, this is the problem. If a large industry could be established somewhere in the desert, something requiring a large block of power, then it may be possible to transmit power by conventional means. But it does seem almost absurd that we're using vast quantities of copper and insulating materials to do this job when the power is on the spot. In 1 square mile of desert, you could produce enough power without any of your transmission lines and any wastage of fuel. And even from the point of view of fuel reserves, we are using up our reserves. The United Kingdom is feeling the pinch already. Within 25 years, at the present rate of consumption of coal, while the stocks of coal available are still not at a dangerous level, the rate at which it can be got out of the ground will be about the same as the rate at which it will be used in 25 years. So that beyond that, industrial progress is likely to be held up in the United Kingdom unless other sources of power are available. Now, the pinch isn't on us yet in this continent and in many other places, but it will be. And I think I prefaced my remarks on this subject by saying that man has always been prodigal in the use of his raw materials. Well, we have to look ahead some hundreds of years, not to the immediate future of our own generation. And we are wasting the power which is available every day from the sun. And it can be used, and I'm quite certain that within even 5 or 10 years, there will be a quite large-scale use of solar power.
Well, I think we've probably...
I would just like to make a little question. Don't mind, Mr. Brown. As a student of various activities, don't you agree, Mr. Speaker,
that everything, every activity, a human activity, must be for man's use. And why look ahead in hundreds of years when no man can look more than a day at a time?
Well, I think the answer to that is to be found in, have a partial answer, in a photograph I showed you of Charles Babbage. Charles Babbage lived at a time where other men such as Kelvin, Rankine, Carnot, the other great men of science, of engineering existed, and many other great men of science. If they had looked 1 year ahead instead of 100 or 200, where would we be today?
I'm going to ask Dean George Curtis to express our thanks to the speaker.
Mr. Chairman, what a very delightful evening we've had tonight, and how very grateful we are to my colleagues. Those of us who known Dean Meyer since he joined us 2 months ago, came here tonight full of expectation, and we've not certainly been disappointed. It's been a thoroughly interesting thing. I speak, of course, entirely as a layman. These things, we know we're in an age of engineering marvels. We know we're in an age where engineering science is vigorous and healthy. To have someone of the authority and with the skill that Dean Meyer has shown us tonight, put these things to us to give us, lift the curtain a little bit on the future and to indicate some of the things that very vigorous, very healthy science, which he serves so with such distinction, is puts us under a very great obligation to him. And on behalf of all of us, Mr. Chairman, may I express to Dean Meyer